So welcome. Can you hear me? Well, from at the back, good. Welcome everyone to this evening's debate on NGOs, a disaster for disasters. Over the last couple of years, we have indeed had quite a few big disasters: the floods in Bangladesh, the tsunami in Sri Lanka and Indonesia, and the earthquake more recently in Pakistan. And we know that NGOs have played a very important and positive role in providing emergency relief. But they have also come under criticism for some of their actions, and in particular, lack of consultation with local people about what kind of relief would be most appropriate for them. And I believe that tsunami evaluation report highlighted the example of boats being produced that quickly turned over in the sea because some NGOs had not properly consulted with the people, and examples of houses being built from metal in Aceh in a tropical climate. And I'm sure there are many more examples. But it's interesting that NGOs have come under criticism, and we would like to provide this opportunity this evening to have a debate on this issue and to look more critically at what NGOs do bring positively to disasters and what can go wrong sometimes and for what reasons. So we have a very illustrious panel this evening to talk about this. And on my left, I have Sir Nicholas Young, who's head of the British Red Cross and has vast experience in a range of different countries. And I believe before that was also head of cancer, the Macmillan Cancer Relief. And during his period there was actually given an honour for his work in cancer research. I've also found out that he is actually an ex-solicitor. And indeed, on my right, Gorik Ooms, who's a chief executive of Médecins Sans Frontières in Belgium, has worked in a range of African countries in Burundi, Mozambique, who's head of MSF in Mozambique, and also, you'll have to admit that you were also an ex-solicitor, so I feel surrounded by lawyers here. And on my far right, I have Mark Pelling from the King's College London, and Mark has written extensively on disasters and NGOs and the issue of risk reduction. And he is the author of The Vulnerability of Cities, Natural Disasters and Social Resilience. So the way we're going to organise it this evening, I'm going to ask each speaker to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes, starting with Sir Nicholas, and after that we will open it up to discussion. Please can I ask you to turn off your mobiles if you've still got them on. Thank you very much. So Sir Nicholas, thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Jude, and good evening, everybody. I didn't realise I was going to come under attack for being a solicitor, as well as for being a head of an aid agency. But I hope there are lots of budding future solicitors in the hall who will be feeling for me after your comments about lawyers. Well, I'm a reformed lawyer. I joined this awful sort of feedback going on. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. I'm a reformed solicitor. I decided that I was in the wrong place as a lawyer, having done 10 years of take. I'm a reformed solicitor. It's still not. It's me, obviously. I must be radioactive or something. Shall I speak from here? Would that be better?
Yes, perhaps we turn these other ones off. Do you have a mobile phone?
It's off. Better? No, it's been off all the time. Okay, right. Try again. I'm a reformed solicitor. I decided to move into the voluntary sector because I wanted to make a difference in people's lives. And I think that's what motivates many of us in the sector. People who have come from many other different professions want to make a difference in people's lives. And that's what I have chosen to do currently through the Red Cross, one of the world's leading humanitarian agencies. In every single country of the world, in every single country where each of you comes from, there is a Red Cross or a Red Crescent organisation. And we work, all of us, in a collective, both to respond to needs in each country, but also to be ready to join our forces together to respond to disasters wherever they happen. And you know, we are proud of the fact that there are 100 million Red Cross volunteers the world over, working in and as part of local communities, and I'm still echoing for some reason, working as part of local communities to build the resilience of local communities to respond to disasters, disaster risk reduction, Mark, in your terms. And I think that's one of the most important points to hoist on board, is that in any disaster, it is actually local people who respond first. They are the ones on the scene. They are the ones who have to respond in the first hours, or in the case of disasters such as the Pakistan earthquake, which happened right up in the hills of Kashmir, for the first few days before aid agencies and government and military forces can be mobilised to get up to them. It's local people who have to respond, and incredibly important that we should be working to build their capacity to respond. I think that's a very important role that agencies have. Now, I could deal with and answer this question, because it is a question, Jude. NGOs, a disaster for disaster, question mark. I could answer this in 1 minute, because, see, I just cannot contemplate, imagine a world, having seen all of the disasters that have happened over the last 5 years, without NGOs, without agencies like the Red Cross, like Oxfam, like MSF, full of experienced, dedicated people, ready to jump at a moment's notice to respond to disaster wherever it takes place in the world. And when you look at the alternatives of the military doing it, or governments doing it, or the UN trying to do it, or business doing it, or individuals trying to cope for themselves, certainly my very strong feeling, and I think of Pakistan particularly, of New Orleans recently, a government, largely government response to the terrible Hurricane Katrina that has been actually woefully inadequate in terms of helping people on the ground. When I think of Banda Aceh in Indonesia, I see there that for all their imperfections, which, Mark, I'm sure you're going to be talking about, for all the imperfections of the agencies, it is actually the agencies on the ground with their humanitarian approach and their focus on the beneficiary, Jude, despite your comments, that actually make the difference and ensure that people in need, whoever, wherever, whatever they are, get the care they need, however imperfectly. And I fully acknowledge that there are legitimate criticisms to make of the responses, which we all seek very hard to learn from. Now, let me just start also by acknowledging those criticisms. In the wake of a major disaster, yes, the response often does look chaotic, because a disaster is by its nature chaotic. And our job, working with each other, working with the government where it is capable, working with the UN system, it is our job to try and reduce that chaos as quickly as we can to some sort of order by focusing on our particular specialities and using our particular skills and experience. But coordination is an issue, because in a disaster, everybody piles in desperate to help. And yeah, sometimes there are agencies there who are not qualified to do what they try to do. Sometimes there are agencies there who get in the way of the experts. I like to think of the Red Cross as an expert disaster response organisation. And I think that's something for us in the sector to actually sort out. Yes, Jude, sometimes responses are inappropriate. I was horrified when I was in Sri Lanka to find examples of inappropriate boats. I mean, boats was a real issue. It kind of caught people's imaginations. Ooh, Sri Lanka, it's an island. Ooh, they must do lots of fishing. Ooh, let's buy them a boat. And some of those boats sank. Some of those boats were completely inappropriate. And the agencies responsible for delivering that, well, they should not be allowed to continue with their responses. And again, I think there's an issue for us in the emergency response sector to deal with them. There's a question about speed of response. Every time I go to a disaster situation, I find myself tortured by the idea that could we have done it quicker, could we have done it better, how can we improve for next time? And I think that's, in terms of learning the lessons, I would say that I think the sector, the aid sector, is becoming increasingly responsible in terms of transparency and accountability. We all undertake independent evaluations of the work that we do. Those evaluations are, in many cases, published on websites, published in the press. And, we hate seeing criticism of things that we've done. We hate recognising that there are things that we could do better. But actually, if we don't recognise those issues, and if we're not called to account, then we're not going to improve. So at the end of the day, it's in all our interests to make sure that we hear the criticisms and learn the lessons. And the media has a role to play there, quite clearly. The media, it's everywhere. It's often at disaster sites before we are. And it has a role to play in helping us learn the lessons. But I think in terms of the media, one really needs to hoist on board that actually the media is interested in selling newspapers. And it's bad news that sells newspapers, not good news. And Jude, if you've been reading nothing but newspapers, you will have a bad impression of the work that aid agencies do. But if I took you by the hand into the hills of Kashmir, into Banda Aceh, and showed you the work that agencies like MSF, like Oxfam, like the Red Cross, reputable, experienced agencies are doing, you would sure see things we could have done better. But I think you would see an awful lot of things that you would think, wow, that is a very impressive response, given the scale of the disaster that we tackled. The benefits that aid agencies bring, I'm hoping to finish in your 10 minutes, you'll tell me if I don't. The benefits. Well, first of all, let's talk about money. Aid agencies are able to raise, thanks to the generosity of you and your parents and your friends, large sums of money to bring to bear on disaster responses. No government would be able to raise those sums of money. I mean, we raised getting on for £100 million from the British people in response to the tsunami, £20 million from the British people in response to the Pakistan earthquake. No government would have been able to raise that money from generous people, because generous people would have trusted no government to spend it wisely and well. They did trust the Red Cross, for which I am truly grateful. I think aid agencies bring a great deal of experience and expertise. The Red Cross has been responding to disasters worldwide since 1860. We have built up a body of experience and expertise, and as a worldwide movement, we bring it to bear in the ways that are appropriate. We in the British Red Cross, we focus on logistics. Whenever there's a big disaster, it's the British Red Cross that takes over the airport and ensure that the aid flights come in effectively and get distributed effectively. The Japanese Red Cross does field hospitals, along with the Norwegian Red Cross. The German Red Cross does water and sanitation. We all, in the Red Cross movement, focus on a particular area of expertise. We know what each other does, and we make sure we don't get in each other's ways. We bring capacity. I guess that very few governments, and we certainly saw this in Sri Lanka, for example, and in Indonesia, there are very few governments that see it as a priority to prepare effectively for disasters. Sri Lanka had no disaster response plan, either at national or at local level. They were completely unprepared. The island of the little Caribbean island of Grenada, which was hit by Hurricane Ivan 2 years ago, had absolutely no disaster response plan. Why? Because hurricanes had always turned left in the past and missed them. Hurricane Ivan turned right. and they were not ready for it. And I think we agencies have a key role to play in bringing resources, experience, capacity where it's needed, when it's needed, that many governments, ours is an exception, but many governments do not have. Let me then come back and talk about that disaster preparedness. The Red Cross, as I said, based in every country in the world, not just based in every country in the world, based in practically every town and village in the world. And one of our key jobs is to try and ensure that local people are equipped and ready to respond. In Bangladesh, they are hit every year by cyclones. It is the Red Cross, working with other agencies, that has built cyclone shelters, great big massive tall structures that people can go to when a cyclone is approaching. And guess what? Red Cross volunteers on bicycles with whistles go out into the fields when a cyclone is approaching and blow those whistles to encourage everyone to get to the cyclone shelter. Very simple, very basic disaster preparedness. Jude, I really must challenge your assertion that agencies pay no attention to beneficiaries. That is simply totally wrong, certainly in my case, certainly in MSF's case, certainly in Oxfam's case, and many other of the experienced agencies. We know that unless we focus on the real needs, the real wants and desires and hopes and fears of the beneficiaries, we know we will end up doing things wrong. We have put a huge amount of effort, for example, in Indonesia, in getting the design of the houses just right, so that there's a cultural fit, so that these are places that people want to live in. Where agencies have done it wrong, they are now pulling down those houses, and that is a tragic waste of resources, which is rightly criticised. I think I can put my hand on my heart and say that that is not something we have ever done. But if we did, we would be rightly criticised for it. It is absolutely vital that we focus on the beneficiaries and that we focus on all the beneficiaries equal, that we pay attention to all communities. In a conflict situation, it is very easy for the government to focus on their friends, not on their enemies. We focus on both because our requirement is to be impartial and neutral. And then let me finally say that I think the agencies have an enormously important role to play in making sure that you people, you generous members of the public, know about disasters, particularly the neglected ones that don't make the newspapers, that don't have pretty pictures attached to them. It's a key role that we play in making sure that you have an opportunity to get engaged with the issues that disasters bring, and have an opportunity to exercise your humanitarian desire to help. Whatever you do, whether it's actively supporting an organisation like the Red Cross as a volunteer or a member of staff, whether it's what you do in just putting 5p... Don't shoot. 5p or a pound in the tin, that is a humanitarian act that we will put to good use in responding to disasters, and we need your help and support. The way forward is about strengthening the capacity of agencies to work with government and with business to ensure effective disaster response. It is about improving coordination on the ground, and we all have an important role to play in doing that. And you can play an important role by giving us more money. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Much indeed. And our next speaker, Gorik Ooms, Chief Executive of MSF Belgium.
I have no idea.
No, okay. I don't either, actually.
Anybody good on PowerPoint?
Let's see. Yeah. Should have been set up already.
If you minimise the main screen,
yeah.
Then behind it, I think there's
something. Do they all follow on? Yes.
Do you want to have a go?
I don't know if you've
sorry for that.
Sorry about that. I don't know if it's just. Oh, God.
Where is that?
I don't know. We're going to get someone. Oh, dear. Sorry about this. Slide 101. It should be fixed.
Slides.
Yes, I know, but it should be following on because it was the one
there's
I saw.
Only one
was.
Slide, yeah.
There's only one slide.
The one that I saw was following on.
If you,
the was the presentation set
if
up?
Go into the slide the presentation that okay. Might reveal the view show.
Yeah. No, it's only there's one slide.
Yes, it looks as though they haven't set the slides up.
Oh,
I sent it to them and they haven't set it up by the look of it. I can't see what's happened, but.
Oh, because these are the only slides we have.
Oh, Jesus, because we've sent everything to you.
Okay,
should we?
Okay.
Sorry about this.
But I have it here.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I try?
Yes.
Can I mess with your machinery?
Emergency relief there for the LSE.
You see, even lawyers can do it. Good night, everyone, and thanks for the invitation. In fact, I wasn't very much interested in coming here and talking about or trying to convince you that all in all, NGOs are doing a good job and that we make mistakes sometimes, but it's worth supporting us, etc. For me, the question is more interesting. We obviously make mistakes in every intervention, but I think that after disasters, we seem to make a bit more mistakes than normal. And I've taken this illustration not to criticize my colleague of the Red Cross, but to illustrate that an organization with almost 150 years of experience in disasters is sending toilet paper to countries where I don't think they use toilet paper very often. But who could resist if it is toilet paper, I'm afraid. But who could resist if you can get two princes packing it, putting it together, and all the publicity that comes with it? So I'm going to try to answer the question, are disasters a disaster for NGOs? And I think to a certain extent they are, and they are due to the lot of money that comes in after disasters. Because this money, of course, it's useful, it's very needed, but it comes with strings attached. And the main string attached is that it has to be used in those contexts. It is earmarked money. So it creates a situation of damned if you do. If you do, go out and collect all that money. And damned if you don't. Damned if you do, many NGOs, I'm sorry to say, don't have the capacity to intervene immediately after such a disaster. But they go for it because it's a source of funding. Coordination becomes a nightmare. NGOs or organizations that have a real relief capacity are pushed away by other organizations that haven't. Because they have to be on the field, they have to plant the flag, they have to show to the cameras that they're doing something useful. I've actually, for the first time in my work with MSF, been in a situation where another NGO offered us a lot of money to take over the project, just to be able to show that they were doing something useful. And all these earmarked funds have to be spent accordingly. But, I mean, it's not free money. You have to put your staff there to do the job, to spend all that money. You have to put your energy, your coordination efforts, And often you end up doing things that normally you wouldn't do, but you do it because you have this money. And that's not good because it reduces your capacity to work in other contexts where perhaps you're more useful. Now, this is perhaps a particular problem for MSF because we are very focused on relief and emergency. We're not doing development, so we're not going into the whole phase of linking relief and rehabilitation and development. But if we take this money, and we know it from experience, and if we don't explain to people that we actually might not need all that money, we end up doing things that we should not do. And I believe it's a situation for other organizations as well. Well, if you don't, the problem is that the public wants us to save lives, and therefore we save lives. And if we can't, we will pretend we can. If, as one single organization, you don't live up to those quite unrealistic expectations, while the others do, you might have a problem. You might lose some of your popularity and your support. And let's face it, I mean, this was a situation near Aceh, a couple of months after it. What can I say? I mean, unfortunately, the dead people from there, they remained dead. We couldn't save their lives. Survivors didn't need that much of real relief. I mean, there were some people who could use help within the first 48 hours, the heavily wounded. But if you couldn't be there in the first 48 hours, the real relief work for international organizations, those who were not there from the beginning, was not very useful. And then when you talk about reconstruction, and when you see those images, I'm sorry, but this is not for MSF. And certainly, I think it's not for many NGOs who were there. I don't think they have the capacity to reconstruct when you have a situation like this. So we decided quite soon after the tsunami to stop keeping up appearances. And we told our donors that we had, in fact, already enough money to do the real relief job, and that we did need their support, but that we needed it for other contexts. And it was a message that was well received in some countries, not so well received in other countries, supported by other NGOs, criticized by yet other NGOs, but I still think that it was the right thing to do. The problem with those earmarked funds and the whole emotional drive behind it is people see things on television, they see catastrophic situation, and they go with the idea, I'm going to give money because I want to save those people right now. Now, in fact, that is already a very convenient illusion, because the real relief work, the real work that happens in the first week, is already prepared, prepaid, it's budgeted, we have an emergency fund in our budget, we have warehouses in several places in the world where we need, I mean, you don't go buying tents immediately after an earthquake. If you don't have the tents at that moment yet, you're not doing real relief. So actually, what you're doing is saying, people, look what we're doing here, and please support us for the next emergency, because now we have emptied our reserves and we need to fill them up again for the next thing. So the basic idea or emotion of, I want to support these people that I'm seeing right now on television, it's not exactly the reality. And really, real effective disaster efforts rely much more on recurrent, non-earmarked donations, what some of you give every month or twice a year or something like that, because it's that money that allows us to buy a stock, to prepare for an emergency intervention. And that's the money that makes a real difference, not the money that comes in the days or in the weeks after the disaster. So it remains a very strong feeling. NGOs rowing against the tide and going against, in fact, this emotion might be punished for it in the long run. We do believe that honesty will pay in the long run, but we need, I guess, a wider debate, not only here, but really a public debate in the media, on the impact of these earmarked funds, the blessings of it, but also the difficulties that come with it. Thank you.
Interesting points there about earmarked money and the money that comes in after disasters. And our next speaker is Mark Pelling, who's going to take up some of these points further.
If you bear with me, I'm going to see if the PowerPoint works. Yeah.
You'll all be pleased to know that LSE doesn't have an emergency relief wing to it.
Great. This is actually probably an earlier draft of what I'd prepared for the final slideshow, but the core arguments are there, so hopefully I won't be too distracted or deviate from what you see. I don't think my task really as an academic was simply to be here as a foil to the practitioners and be kind of unnecessarily critical, but what I want to do is rather to step back from some of the detail of managing disaster relief and reconstruction and look at the political contexts that constrain what NGOs are able to do. And indeed, perhaps not just talk about NGOs, but some of the other civil society actors, nascent political parties, community-based organisations, perhaps groups of individuals that don't have any formal organisation. I'm going to talk to these three main themes. And as you can see, I want to talk around the theme of human security. And I hope this doesn't throw unnecessary confusion into the talk, but human security is certainly a way in which many policymakers have started to talk about disaster management, disaster risk reduction. So it's a set of ideas that we need to engage with. So I'm going to suggest that it's not necessary, that there are actually some advantages to thinking about human security, that it allows us to think about disasters as political events, and humanitarian actors, despite their apparent neutrality, as political actors. Then I'll say something about the evolving landscape, the landscape of institutions, new policy initiatives within which NGOs are having to operate. And finally, point to three different areas where I, as an outside commentator at least, see particular opportunities and realities of change for NGOs. All in 10 minutes. First of all, and this is the very quick bit of theory, why are we interested in human security? I think it's particularly interesting because human security pulls us away from national security. So in doing that, straight away we ask a question, whose security? So if we're interested, as in this debate, in disasters, a disaster for who? The disasters that we've heard illustrated are very large-scale events. These are almost disasters for the nation or the region of a nation in which they take place, as well as the individuals, households, local economies and so on within them. But there are many smaller disasters that take place at the level of 4 or 5, 10 people being impacted. Are they disasters? They're certainly not disasters for the state, but they are for local communities. So the UNDP definition of human security is one that it's security for individuals, not the nation state, and that's particularly relevant to this debate, I think. They go further than just saying that human security is about individuals, but that it brings together two big areas of work in development, two areas where NGOs have been at the forefront, and this is delivering or working with people to achieve basic needs, and supporting empowerment and human rights. So the basic needs is a kind of collective area of action, human rights focusing on the individual. And I'm going to argue that NGOs in response and reconstruction are rather good at providing basic needs, but not at meeting human rights. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. And in doing that, in not building human security. A caveat to the whole human security debate, which I'll gloss over for now, is that security is another word for control. And certainly there's a huge discussion about that and the extent to which even international development policy now, if it's seen through the lens of human security, shifts from development as being a right, development as being progressive, to development as a way of providing people with just enough to protect them being unruly and a potential threat to certain international vested interests. So it changes the whole way we think about the delivery of development, which is dangerous, perhaps. So just one quick case study that talks to human security. The 1999 Mamar earthquake, a large event, at least 18,000, some civil society activists say up to 40,000 people killed. This is an event where different actors in civil society were able to open political space so that the disaster morphed from being a set of actions around the delivery of basic needs to a set of issues around human rights. And this is just the time frame, you know, just a few quick bullet points to give you a sense of what happened. So earthquake, within 17 hours, there was a full media complement. International local media was there. It took 5 days for the Red Crescent, National Red Crescent Society, which is quite close to the state in Turkey, to have a strong presence. That is actually unusual. Red Cross and Red Crescent organisations are typically very good first responders. And I'm sure there were individuals associated with the Red Crescent who were there on the ground, on the spot. But in terms of an organised organisational response, delivering relief aid, 5 days. 14 days for the state. This is logistical issues. Roads were down, bridges were down, aid was arriving but not getting to the people who needed it. So what happened for those 5 days, or for those 14 days? That's what happened. Local actors, predominantly organised around religious societies, not necessarily with a strong religious conviction, but a religious identity, so Islamic organisations, took over disaster response and relief. As we've heard already, it's the first 48 hours, perhaps the first 24 hours after a disaster, where lives are saved. So disasters are local events. International agents have a huge role to play in reducing the likelihood of a disaster through development acts and in contributing to reconstruction. But that immediate point of a day or 2 days invariably requires local actors. The political outcome of this, of local civil society organising, coming to the fore, was that the state reacted, some would say aggressively, and took away the budgets, the working budgets of those religiously affiliated NGOs. And not just the aid budgets, but the core working budgets. So at around 14 days, civil society was weakened. There was a civil society response, public protests and so on, and actually that particular rule by the government to close down budgets was rescinded. And this is a particular case. It's a case where you have a weak government, multiple parties held in a coalition, particular sensitivities to religious and ethnic groups in the country. But my point of showing you this is to suggest that there are other actors that are as important as those that are represented here, and that disasters are political events. So with that in mind, a couple of other points to make. What are the broad sets of ideas that NGOs are often at the forefront of innovating? One of these, a phrase that we've heard already, disaster risk reduction. The notion that the best way of saving lives, protecting livelihoods, is not through relief, not through reconstruction, but through development. At the same time, recognising that every disaster is a failure of development as has been enacted. Every school that fell down in Pakistan was once a development project. So trying to do development better, and there's increasing energy in this field. There's 30 years of academic writing and lobbying from some civil society actors and within government to put this up the agenda, and we are getting some movement now. DFID is doing rather well, UNDP supporting this, and yes, we're at a moment now where there's good practice being recognised in the field. So this is a quite a positive era for serious engagement with risk reduction. Human rights, it's just to throw out to you the notion that by and large, civil society actors, NGOs in the north and internationally, support civil rights during development. So the rights of individuals to have freedom of speech, to be able to congregate in groups, to protest against the state in normal development is, you know, unproblematic. It doesn't happen in disasters. As you saw in Turkey, there were 2 weeks then, a two-week period, where civil society organised, provided development, and then the state responded to that, saw it as a threat. And there wasn't an international outcry. There wasn't even an international murmur to that. And this is something that happens repeatedly in disasters. When the state weakens, civil society tends to come to the fore. Sometimes it's negative in terms of people's freedoms, and you know, it can be a case where violence erupts. In other times, as I'd argue in Turkey, it was more positive. But there isn't this international support. Finally, privatisation. The notion that not only is there an increasing amount of money being devoted to relief and reconstruction, but that there are new actors involved. NGOs are some of these actors, but the private, for-profit private sector are also there. And there's a tremendous lack of transparency in governance. Certainly, the state is often not a significant player in reconstruction. Even things as simple as tendering out of buying basic goods for building houses. It won't be a competitive tender for buying goods. That's not a criticism of individual NGOs, but of the sort of norms of practice that NGOs, governments, UN agencies, donors find themselves falling into. And the final point here, and this is my last slide, kind of flag why that is. These are just three areas, fault lines, if you like, where civil society donors are rethinking or perhaps need to rethink the way in which they engage with development and disasters and reconstruction together. One goes back to the idea of human security, that humanitarians are rather good at providing basic needs, but less good at supporting human rights, political rights. So that part of the development opportunity after disaster, I'm arguing, is being lost. Now, one way around that NGOs are practicing, is to engage very much in communities at risk before disaster, so that you understand the micro-political situation, the larger national political situation, livelihoods, gender relations, and can help to reinforce rights as well as basic needs through that knowledge. So the sense that information and ownership of reconstruction should be local, and international actors can certainly and really must facilitate that. But to think of the response to disasters as being led by international agencies isn't ideal. It, as we've heard already, is perhaps, you could argue, a necessity because of a lack of capacity, but it shouldn't be what we aim to achieve. And the last tension between speed and sustainability, this puts together two impossible aims of NGOs, anyone working in relief, that both aims must be met, but can't be met at the same time. The notion that there are core provisions that need to be provided for people with speed in reconstruction, housing, primary health care, potable water, food, some basic personal security. And set against that, the aspiration that response should be a period for building local capacity through enabling people to take part in decision making, to create sustainability, to create economies, local livelihoods, social relations that persist and open up opportunities for development. But the two are in some ways are in conflict, speed and sustainability. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We'll now be opening up the floor for discussion, and we'll finish at 7:45. If anybody wants to leave in that time, could I please ask you to leave now so that we're not interrupted during the question and answer session? What I'll do is I'll start off by taking some questions individually. Please, can you give your name and where you're from? And keep your questions short so we can maximise participation. So please try to avoid any long speeches about something you are particularly concerned about. We have a few people coming in who were not able to get in before. Okay, I'm now going to open it up for questions. Yes. We should have a travelling microphone.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the contributions. One of the points near the end... Angela Franklin. One of the points near the end of the last presentation certainly seemed to be saying definitely that NGOs should, if you like, be opportunistic and, if you like, take advantage of a disaster situation to enable more human rights, as you put it, the political rights. If you're really saying that, then what do the other two speakers think about this, in that governments would in fact be quite right to suspect allowing help in from foreign NGOs? Now, we might all think it would be a good aim, but mightn't it be, make a disadvantage for the first needed help for the basic needs?
Thank you. A very pertinent question. Who would like to... respond, Mark? Do you want to respond on that initially?
Well, no, I mean, I think that's exactly the issue, and it's been around for a long time. And yeah.
Okay, Corrick, can you check it's on?
Yes. Yeah. I must admit that we're not that far on this issue. We are increasing debates or discussions mainly with development organisations around the human rights approach. The difficulty, I think personally, is that there is a contradiction somehow in the human rights approach and the sustainability approach used by development organizations. For example, for us as a medical organization, if you use the concept of the right to health, then certainly in a very poor country, in a post-conflict situation, it's completely unacceptable to introduce user fees, because you are going to exclude the most vulnerable population, the women, the children, etc. And you see it, and there's a lot of evidence about it. But still, most development NGOs or agencies aiming for sustainability will tell you that free healthcare is a humanitarian approach that is not affordable in the long run, that is not sustainable. And therefore, it's kind of hard to mix those two. I think we, and certainly the Red Cross, we are quite familiar with the legal approach or the human rights approach in the sense that it's not that far from humanitarian law, which is incredibly important in our work because it allows us to address states while remaining some kind of neutrality by saying we're not blaming you, the government or the army of Israel, because we dislike you, because we are part, we have taken part. We blame you because there's a humanitarian law and you're doing things that are not in accordance with. So it would in itself be, I think, relatively easy to include some human rights approach, even if we're never going to be a human rights organization. But the issue of sustainability is a very important one and a very difficult one. I use the example of user fees. I could use the example, very difficult one, of AIDS treatment. When we started AIDS treatment in Africa, most development agencies said it was madness. Most NGOs said it was madness because it's not sustainable, it's not affordable. Even with prices reduced, you're working in countries where the national health budget is below $10 per person per year, and you're providing a treatment at $150 per person per year. If you use a human rights approach, it's very simple. Those people have a right to health care, and essential health care includes antiretroviral medicine if that's the ones you need. So again, I like the whole concept, but I think that development agencies or experts should think also about the issue of sustainability because that's the real barrier between us.
Yes, I think this is a hugely important and a very difficult question, and the issue of sustainability is one that certainly worries us in the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement too, but being primarily a disaster response organisation, we recognise that actually, you know, Angela, it's more of an issue for our brothers and sisters in the development community. But I think the point you made about governments being very wary of a human rights approach is absolutely spot on. In the Red Cross movement, we have two very important fundamental principles of impartiality and neutrality. We as an organisation tend not to speak up and speak out in public on issues because the danger is that when you do that, particularly when you do it in a country, if you like, that is not your own, you do tend to step on toes and upset organisations like governments that control access to people who need our help. And so we don't speak up and speak out. And sometimes we get very heavily criticised for that because people quite understandably say, look, the Red Cross, you are so powerful. If you speak up, the government would surely take note. Yes, possibly, but equally possibly and more worryingly, if the government then, in response to our public criticism, denied us access to those who had need of our services, the argument very strongly, and the argument that would win the day within the Red Cross movement, is that we would be failing in our duty to gain access to as many people who need help as we possibly can. So we tend not to speak up and speak out in public, but to rely on our access at all levels of governments and the fact that governments kind of recognise that this deal, there is a deal here, which says that provided you don't criticise us in public, then you can come and talk to us in private and make your private representations about the issues. And so, you know, have a discussion with us at least, not promising we'll do anything, but have a discussion with us at least about what needs to be done. I mean, I give as an example Turkmenistan, a country that I happen to know fairly well because we have a long-standing relationship with the Turkmenistan Red Crescent, trying to build their capacity. They have a real, their real difficulty in Turkmenistan is certainly if they spoke up about the regime, they'd be finished. And even if they spoke up too publicly about what they do they'd be finished, because there's an implied criticism that if you need the Red Cross to do stuff for people, the government must be doing something wrong. So very difficult tightrope that they have to walk in the Turkmenistan Red Crescent around this whole issue of whether to speak up and what to say, and the worry that if you do so, you lose access to the people who need your help.
Okay, thank you very much. Gentleman over there. There will be a microphone coming to you.
Hello. Speak from a slightly unknowledgeable...
Sorry, your name, and are you from LSE?
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm George, but I'm just a random member of the public off the street, so... first, thank you. Thank you all for coming. Question really revolves around something that Sir Nicholas touched on. Really, do you think that from an outsider's point of view, the industry appears to be quite fragmented in the sense that you've got a wide variety of different organizations of different sizes with different capabilities and specialities? Do you think that it would benefit from a central body, perhaps something that the UN or one of your organizations could implement, that would provide a conduit for sharing best practice, sharing knowledge, and perhaps also providing a framework for response in disaster situations?
Okay, thank you.
Well, to some extent, these frameworks either exist now or are beginning to exist. I mean, you know, the UN has as a basic part of its function, UN OCHA, for example, has as a basic part of its function the task of helping and supporting governments to coordinate the response to disasters. And, you know, some governments are quite good at that. You know, the Pakistan government actually did a reasonable job in helping to coordinate the agencies. Some governments are extremely bad at it. Sri Lanka would perhaps be an example of that. So the UN, there you are, that's part of the answer. And some reform proposals to the UN system currently being actively developed are the suggestion that agencies should work together in clusters, coordinated either by one agency or more likely by a UN body, to coordinate a response, both strategic, at the sort of strategic supranational level, and at the local level when disaster strikes. And, you know, I think that's a really important idea. I think it's starting to develop. There are concerns and issues about it. But I think anything that encourages and forces agencies to share information and ideas and actual implementation and operations on the ground are good. Within the UK, we have a body called the DEC, the Disasters Emergency Committee, that seeks to coordinate the fundraising activities of some of the major aid agencies when disaster strikes. And increasingly, you know, that Disasters Emergency Committee, of which I'm a trustee and the Red Cross is a member, you know, we commission evaluations on a collective basis, and we publish the results of those evaluations, and we seek to learn from those evaluations. But I think the bottom line, I think, is that you're right. It is at heart the system fragmented. The argument in favour of that is many flowers bloom and lots of different agencies, and you know, you can understand that argument. But the downside is that sometimes the response is chaotic, or appears chaotic, at least in the early days. And I think we're all trying to sort of grope our way towards making that better. But when you think that, you know, in Sri Lanka there are several hundred agencies in the very early days descended on a tiny space and desperately tried to help, you know, many of them got in each other's way. Most of them have now gone. But a stronger coordinating body there and then would have helped stop that.
Well, I think MSF is not that much in favor of stronger coordination, in the sense that the UN has has several mandates, and they're very different, and they don't often mix well together. I mean, the peacekeeping or the military mandate of the UN combined with the humanitarian aid mandate they have and with the development aid gives some very strange situation. For example, most recently in Darfur, where you could see that the delivery of aid was somehow linked in certain areas with the willingness of certain parties to sign a peace agreement, yes, and therefore people not getting aid because whoever had the guns refused to sign the paper, was not only bad for the peace agreement, apparently, because people signed something they didn't believe in, and at the same time withholding humanitarian aid from the people who needed it is not something that we would favor. And again, the mixture of the humanitarian and the development agenda within the UN can cause problems, like the one I mentioned before, the introduction of user fees in DRC, where people are extremely poor, the conflict continues, because we try to do everything together, give peace, relief, the basic needs, and start development, and it all looks great on paper, but in reality, it's not so great.
The only thing I'd add to that is, certainly in the tsunami, whilst the larger NGOs were to some extent coordinated and had their own transparency, which was quite public, the huge number of smaller NGOs, civil society connections, not even organisations, and the amount of money and resource that went through those were completely untransparent, unaccountable. So that's something quite new as a strategic issue. Maybe it was something particular to the scale of the tsunami, and certainly long on slow onset disaster events tend not to have that huge diversity of organisations at that scale. But it's an issue. There is some sort of coordination by default with particular NGOs tending to specialise in certain sectors. So you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but Red Cross has taken a lead role in shelter.
Correct.
I think, and Oxfam tends to work well in water provision. So you know, that's one way of working through this without people having to go to inordinate numbers of coordinating meetings, which has been a burden in the past. Yeah.
Thank you. I have a question from up in the balcony. Yes.
Okay, I'll shout. My name is Ben, and I work at Tier Fund. All of the speakers have acknowledged that there is poor practice by international NGOs in disasters. Self-regulation through signing up to things such as the Red Cross Code of Conduct is clearly not working. Is it now time for accreditation and regulation by an external body?
Thank you.
Well, there are several already, and many of them linked with funding. For example, if you want to apply for ECHO funds, you need to be able to show that you can live up to certain standards. You have the Sphere project, you know, obviously you have the Code of Conduct. I'm quite skeptical about most of those initiatives. I tend to think that it's mainly the job of the media to regulate or to make sure that people know what happens. The problem is somehow that a lot of media are involved in those big fundraisers, especially if you have the tsunami one. I don't know how it was here, but certainly in Belgium, all the major newspapers, televisions, etc., were participating in the big fundraising event. Obviously, those journalists are not going to come back a couple of months later. Well, perhaps we raised too much money and perhaps part of it is not used, because they were part of the asking for money. And I think there is a real issue of uncritical reporting about some of the stuff that is being done.
Well, clearly you have a very different press in Belgium to the press we have here, Gorik, because yes, I mean, the newspapers and the TV here played a key role in helping us raise large sums of money. But they've equally played a key and major role in holding some of us, you know, up to comment and criticism for the way we have responded. And I think, as I mentioned in my earlier comments, you know, I agree with you. I think the media does have that role. But I suppose I wish, well, I would say this, wouldn't I? But I mean, I wish that it was a bit more even-handed. You know, I mean, it's very easy to go to the wilderness of Banda Aceh that you showed on your slide, and you know, find people who are unhappy with the aid and response that they've received. It is true. Equally, you could go there and find hundreds, if not thousands, who are perfectly content and feel they've been well helped and well looked after. And I wish that some of our beloved newspapers would, you know, play that role of a slightly more open, even-handed approach, the coverage. I mean, you know, some of them are pretty rabid in the way they cover this stuff. But I want to come back to the question of regulation, which I know is in the news, Ben, following Mr. Cameron's comments at the Conservative Party conference. I think one of his colleagues who was suggesting that there should be a regulatory body. You know, I find that a tough one. I absolutely think that agencies have to be accountable and that there has to be a transparency around how we use the money that generous people have given us. But whether some kind of supra-agency body can do that without a huge civil service and a huge infrastructure which will cost vast sums of money, I don't know. I mean, there was a recent evaluation report conducted by a sort of consortium of consultants about the response to the tsunami, called the Tsunami Evaluation Coalition, which produced 142 documents. It cost $3 million. And it was a kind of indigestible lump of comments, most of which had come out in other reports already. And I'm agnostic about that being the right way forward. I think I feel reasonably confident that agencies are sufficiently open to comment and criticism and constructive advice and proper full evaluation. And I would hope that we could be trusted to do that effectively. But I think if there is a strong public feeling that we can't, then I would welcome regulation as a way of helping reassure the public that actually we can. Not always, not everywhere, not every time, but most of the time.
Yeah. And certainly the DEC, which you've mentioned already, is one step towards a sort of self-regulatory framework amongst the larger NGOs. And I think I would agree that that's a very positive and manageable intervention, something more top-down, I'm not sure, would help in the diversity that we have at the moment. There is some self-policing. So.
Thank you. I'm going to take two or three questions lumped together. Someone from over here, the gentleman sitting in the middle, the blue shirt. Oh, behind, yes. I'll take one from the lady here.
Thank you. I'm Shafiq from Pakistani administered Kashmir, and I was recently based in this earthquake responding there. There are two, three, like, important questions. Unfortunately, there wasn't a serious...
Can you just mention one?
Huh?
Keep your question to one question. Thank you.
Okay. There was less discussion on NGOs, a disaster for disaster, but there was a more of the gloomy pictures what we are doing in the areas. There are two, three... regarding this coordination and all these things, I mean... Though there are chaotic situations and all these things, but we should be professional enough to actually coordinate. But that what we do purposely, because we could say that we were the first one to reach in that area, in that area. And regarding transparency and accountability, let me give you a very example. There was a serious tentage shortage in that earthquake area, and one of the organization contacted Switzerland office to buy, and they contacted them to Dubai office, and they had contracted in the Lahore, again in Pakistan. You see that the tent which cost like $100 or $150 was about $350 or $400. So, I mean, we define ourselves what is the accountability and what is, we do the evaluations and everything. And then there is like, we all say that investing in the local people. But actually, in the humanitarian situations, we undermine that seriously. If I mention like ICRC and IFRC together, I mean, there was hundreds of people from like their own bases or regions, countries of origin, and hundreds of car from their own areas. So seriously undermining, and there was second or third category managers from the local areas, rather of giving them real opportunity to work.
Okay, I have to move on in a moment. Okay, so we thank you for your...
Thirdly, comments. I mean, they feel it very easy. Those who are not from that area and the go, like particularly you and again ICRC, etc., they feel it very convenient to work with the armies and the government and to reach out to people rather of believing in the real civil society or the NGOs networks around.
Thank you. And just one last question, the lady here. Can we... get the microphone over here, and that will be our last question before we wind up.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Sharifa Marlina. I'm actually from Aceh. So, of course, I witnessed the massive destruction which happened in Aceh, and also, well, approximately, I believe that about 500 NGOs are currently operating in Aceh, and they're providing... well, assistance in one side, and of course in another side also creating problem. Well, I mean, I've seen that a lot of NGOs, they are competing each other in providing assistance. For example, in school buildings, then in the same location, it could be two or three NGOs are saying that this is the location that we should build a school. And that's one of the fact that the coordination is not good. Well, I mean, I agree with you that you've seen that coordination is always an issue in this, I mean, massive destruction and massive disaster. But one question for me is, to what extent actually do you consider it is important to consult with public, to community in this case? Because in fact, I mean, we see that the community is always in the position, they don't have power to say that we want this, we want that. And it's in most cases that I found that public consultation or consultation with the beneficiaries, it's always only a jargon. In fact, the NGOs already have their own theories that they want to prove, and that they want really to feel tested that theory. Thank
right.
you.
Thank you very much. So our final question is the consultation just jargon? And Sir Nicholas and Gorik, what do you think about that?
I don't think so. I mean, I can only speak for my own agency, and I'd try and pick up the point that Jaffe was making from Pakistan as well. There is a real difficulty about in responding to disasters, because, you know, you want to get out there quickly, and so you tend to start with the people you've already got on your team. And what we try to do within the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement is work with and through the local Pakistan Red Crescent, Indonesian Red Crescent, knowing and believing, and I think the PMI in Indonesia did a fantastic job, knowing and believing that their volunteers, their staff, and the same in Pakistan, will be better equipped and able to understand and communicate with and consult with the local people about their needs and the way they want the disaster response to be handled. And, you know, having visited Banda Aceh now two or three times, I've been on the islands, Pulau Aceh and so on, where we're working. And I can certainly see the huge importance and benefits of really proper consultation with beneficiaries. I feel that we can hold, we in the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement can hold our heads up and say that we've done it pretty well. It takes time. It's enormously difficult. And there is a question, you know, you consult one group and, you know, you feel you've done your consultation, but another group has a slightly different perspective, a slightly different set of needs, a slightly different context. And, you know, you end up not perhaps fully satisfying them. I mean, it's very difficult. It's hugely important. And we have to keep on trying to get better and better at it. And I think your point about local people being and feeling sometimes disempowered when a great avalanche, a tsunami of Western agencies descends on them and their community, I absolutely understand. And I think the more we can equip local communities, and this is the point you were making,
local communities, local people, local NGOs to be ready and up and willing and able to respond, the better. If I could work myself out of a job, I really would.
Thank you. Any final brief comments?
Yeah, just to recognize that we're not very good at it, and especially in the first phase of the relief, if you want to save lives in the first 24, 48 hours, you go in with a standard approach with kits that are prepared, that are in warehouses with tents that have been made for several situations that are not always adapted to the real needs. I don't see a real solution for that. If the more important is afterwards to get some feedback and evaluations and then include and see how you adapt, for example, the kits of non-food items, what's important and what not. But, I mean, again, this is particular for MSF. I just wanted to tell one story about boats, because this was when our team on the field decided not to follow the standard approach, and actually the people said, we don't need medical care, we don't need all this stuff, we need boats, we need to go fishing again. And so we said, this is not our job, ask the other, the more development NGOs to do it. And they said, yes, but this is months have passed since the tsunami. They come and do assessments all over again and again and again. And when we approached them, they said, yes, but we cannot start anything before we assess the whole needs of the whole coast and before we have a plan to make it perfect for everyone. And so our logisticians decided to give the people of the village the means, some wood and a saw, to build the boats themselves. And that was the one point where we got criticized in the tsunami evaluation for going beyond our mandate. So it's not so easy. I don't think so, because we didn't make any boats. We're smart enough to know that we cannot make it. So we gave the means to the local people to do it. But then one of the critics was that they used wood that was illegally taken from, and then the people said, yes, but we're doing this since ages. We just cut the same trees that we're always cutting to make boats. So not exactly in our field of competence.
And Mark, the final word.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm just trying to think of something that could be done locally in the donor countries to respond to some of this, and some of the constraints are certainly built by us and by our representatives. And one of the, as I understand it, main constraints for local actors and international actors on the ground is the short funding time. So money from donors has to be expended within 12 months, at the most 3 years. That's something set by our governments, not by people working and doing relief. And so you can, that just ups the ante on competition. Need to just spend the money, don't care where. And the other point linked to that is the way in which NGOs are becoming increasingly trapped, like environmental organisations, to use the media as a way of generating revenue. And disasters are a great way of doing that. Everyday development is less attractive, and yet it is a development problem. Disasters are just part of development. So you as the public, you know, hold it in your power, as well as the NGOs, to try and address that imbalance.
I just want to come in and pick up a point, because Gorick made the point as well about earmarked funding. And, you know, I understand what you're saying about, you know, as a charity you're raising earmarked funding, in other words, you know, we get money to spend in Indonesia, we have to spend it in Indonesia. And, you know, yes, I accept that there is a downside to that in that, you know, sometimes if you have raised too much, and that hasn't happened often in my experience, but if by some faint chance you have raised too much, then you're under pressure to, you know, just spend it somehow. This happened actually to the American Red Cross after 9/11. I mean, they raised $1 billion in about 6 days, and it was too much, because if you were involved in 9/11, you were either dead or you were fine. And so they really did have difficulty spending that money. So that's one example. But actually, there is a benefit to earmarked funding, and that is that, you know, if you give me £1 to spend in Indonesia, I've got to spend it in Indonesia. And that's a benefit to the donors and a discipline for us to make sure that we do spend it in accordance with the donors' wishes. So I'll collect my £1 later from you, sir. But, you know, I think you have to recognise that there is that balance there.
OK, Okay, well, I'd like to thank... we're finishing now, and I'm sure many of you have questions, and we can continue talking about this upstairs in the reception. I'd like to thank our speakers for a very stimulating discussion of this question, are NGOs a disaster for disasters? Well, we know LSE would be if it went into emergency relief, and I think we're all relieved they're not doing that. But I certainly think you've given us a lot of food for thought. There will be a reception upstairs in Cafe Pepe, so please do make your way up there and you can have a chance to talk further about this amongst yourselves or with the speakers. Thank you very much indeed.